Our first case for argument, United States v. Tanner. Ms. Gambino.
Good morning, Judge Posner, Judge Mannion, and Judge Hamilton. Charles Tanner did not have a fair trial. His rights were violated by the court and by the prosecution by denying him his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, by the admission of evidence which was not relevant and which was prejudicial and whose prejudicial value outweighed its probative value, and by the failure to give significant jury instructions with respect to the fact that cooperators cannot be conspirators, and the giving of a jury instruction, an ostrich instruction, which was not justified by the evidence. Finally, Mr. Tanner was sentenced to an unreasonable sentence of life imprisonment in view of the fact that neither the nature of the offense nor his personal history, characteristics, and background justified such a severe sentence. I will begin by discussing the violation of his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. In this particular case, the government's closing argument, its rebuttal argument, consisted entirely of going through all of the evidence, asserting that it was unrebutted, and that the defendant had failed to present any evidence to rebut the government's evidence. And particularly egregious was the claim, or the focus on the fact, that the defendant did not rebut the introduction of his own confession. Under this court's case in United States versus Cottman, it's been held that direct comment on a defendant's failure to testify is strictly forbidden, and that's a basis for reversal.
But isn't it an invited error? Because his lawyer says that his lawyer gets up and says that all this character evidence was unrebutted. And so the prosecutor said, oh, you want to talk about rebuttal? You want to talk about rebuttal? Well, you haven't rebutted any of our evidence, right? I mean, why isn't that, a natural response? If the defense lawyer thinks it's really significant that his character evidence wasn't rebutted, why isn't it, sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander?
Well, that's certainly a natural response, and perhaps a one-off comment might be understandable, if not forgivable. But even this court has said that, for instance, in United States versus Howard, that when a defendant invites or makes an improper comment, that the proper response for the state is to object to the trial judge and not to continue the error by making improper comments to the jury.
But it wasn't an improper comment by the defense lawyer. It was perfectly proper, because it was true that the character evidence hadn't been rebutted. There's nothing to object to. What could you object to?
Well, if he thought that it was objectionable, then he should have done
that. What could you object to? There's nothing to object to.
That's correct. I don't think there was anything.
Right. There's nothing to object to. But on the other hand, if the defendant is injecting, and the defense lawyer is injecting the issue of rebuttal and significance of rebuttal, then why can't the prosecutor say, my evidence is unrebutted also. Why can't you just say that?
Well, if he had just said that, that might not have been objectionable from the defense. But what he did was impermissible. He commented on the defendant's failure to testify, which is in violation.
Well, he didn't actually say that, right? You focused on the statement that the confession was unrebutted.
That's correct.
If the confession was false, wouldn't there have been witnesses, potentially other than the defendant himself, who could have helped rebut that?
Your Honor, no. In fact, the only person that could have rebutted what the agent said about what he said was himself. I mean, two agents testified about what they asserted Mr. Tanner had said to them. The only person who could have rebutted what he said or the fact that he said it would have been Mr. Tanner.
What about the contents of the supposed confession, though?
The contents of the supposed confession also would have been rebuttable by Mr. Tanner.
And only him?
With respect to what his intent was and with respect to what the conversations were between he and any other individual, and certainly...
Well, then presumably those other individuals could also testify, other people who he said were involved in the drug distribution conspiracy could also have testified to rebut that, right?
It's theoretically possible, but each of those...
Isn't that enough under Mitas?
I don't believe it is enough, Your Honor, because in the particular facts of Mitas, what happened was that there were three people actually present, and one of the co-defendants did actually testify. And the question in Mitas was one of indirect implication of the assault on the Fifth Amendment privilege, because they commented on what was said when the other defendant testified. That's a completely different situation than we have here, because what we have here is a very specific statement. What the prosecutor said was that perhaps the most important thing that is unrebutted that you've heard nothing in defense closing argument about is the defendant's own confession. It's unrebutted that Charles Tanner chose on his own to meet with Chris Allen right there and Elena Iatarola, those two FBI special agents. It's unrebutted, sat downstairs while defendant poured out his heart to them. It's unrebutted that he confessed like that to a major narcotics conspiracy over 5 kilos. And then there was an objection, which was overruled. And then he continued. It's unrebutted that he confessed that he was getting drugs from Renee. It's unrebutted, ladies and gentlemen, that he, in his own words, confessed to this conspiracy to not one, but two FBI agents. So it's not exactly dealing with the particulars, with the exception of the mention of this individual, Renee, who was an uncharged, unindicted individual. It's really focusing on the fact that he sat down and confessed to these FBI agents, and he didn't get up on the stand and rebut it and say either, no, I didn't say those things, or they're wrong in what they're saying that I said.
But where would that line be? The prosecutor would have been able to say, for example, ladies and gentlemen, I remind you about the testimony of these agents who described in detail Mr. Tanner's confession. Could he go on then to say you haven't heard any testimony to the contrary?
No, he could not, because he is not permitted either directly or...
Can't even say that.
No, not directly or indirectly to remind the jury that Mr. Tanner didn't testify.
Can say the defense didn't lay a glove on them in cross-examination. That would be okay.
No, I think if he said the defense, I think that even would be walking the line very closely.
Really?
Because what is going on here is that the jury can then infer or make its own inferences about what they think or don't think, and they'll be instructed or should be instructed that they're not to draw any inferences about his failure to testify. But the state cannot point to it, and the judge cannot condone it, which he did essentially three times during the course of this rebuttal argument. Three objections were made to the prosecutor pointing out that the defendant didn't testify, that he didn't rebut the evidence, and each time the objections were overruled.
Well, he never actually said the defendant didn't testify, did he?
He didn't say those words, but when
he said the prosecution's evidence was unrebutted in various respects.
Well, he was more specific than that. He didn't only say. We have, in the course of this long rebuttal, where he repeats 17 different times, our evidence is unrebutted. Not only did he go through and say, this piece was unrebutted, this piece was unrebutted, this piece was unrebutted, but then he specifically points to the defendant's confession. And that is a direct mention of the fact that this defendant did not stand up there and rebut his own words coming out of the mouth of these agents.
The problem is he was using the word unrebutted, which he repeated from the defense attorney, and that if he had just said he could easily remind the jury about the confession and the testimony and go on and on, he shouldn't have said unrebutted, at least in what you're saying. And he maybe got walked into saying unrebutted unnecessarily. But as far as the evidence of the confession, he could certainly remind the jury that that testimony, two witnesses, whatever, and just make that evidence pretty overwhelming.
Certainly he could have. He could have and he should have. But the problem with this argument is that he didn't stop and that he took it across the line, and not just across the line, but way across the line. And I see, Your Honor, that my time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gambino.
We would ask for a reversal, remand for new trial, or in the alternative for a new sentencing.
Thank you. Mr. Bella?
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Daniel Bell, arguing the case on behalf of the government. The defense counsel spent most of her time talking about the closing argument, and so I'll address that first. The government counsel's use of the word unrebutted in his rebuttal closing argument was clearly a barb aimed right back at defense counsel, who started down that road with his use of the word unrebutted. And it was a barb aimed at defense counsel, not at the defendant. The government counsel used the word unrebutted. He used the word to introduce a succession of sentences and a portion of his oral argument. And it was the use of a rhetorical device. Anaphora is the repetition of a word or phrase at the beginning of sentences, and most often cited example of it is Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So was this a rhetorical device that government counsel was using and was aimed back at defense counsel because of the technique that he used in his argument in the use of that word? So what matters isn't how many times government counsel used the word, because that's the whole purpose of a rhetorical device. What counts is what he was really saying. And the whole point of his argument was that defense counsel has told you that these things are important, talking about the character witnesses, and these things are rebutted. Well, I'll tell you what's really important. And what government counsel then did was look at four broad categories of government evidence. He looked at the phone calls, at the video, at the surveillance of the 15-kilo deal, and at the confession. And in each one of these segments, he starts his argument by saying, what's unrebutted, defense counsel didn't tell you anything about it, is this, and then went through the government's evidence. With regard to each one of those four categories of evidence, government counsel used the word unrebutted in conjunction with talking about defense counsel. You didn't hear a word about it from defense counsel. Did government counsel intend, what we do is not count the number of uses of the word unrebutted. We look at what I would suggest that what the message was of government counsel. And as I say, it was thrown directly back at defense counsel. The question that if we engage in some analysis, as we said, the questions to be asked are, did government counsel intend this to be a comment on the defendant's failure to testify? Did the jury likely take it as a comment on the defendant's failure to testify? And did the comments deprive the defendant of a fair trial? And I think the answer to all those questions are no. The comments weren't a comment on defendant's failure to testify. They were a barb thrown back at defense counsel. The jury saw the context. That's the context in which the jury heard the government counsel's oral argument or a rebuttal argument. That's the context in which they heard it. So the jury could understand it as a give and take between defense counsel and government counsel. So I think the jury was unlikely to take it as a comment on the defendant's failure to testify.
Mr. Bella, could you address in particular the point about the defendant's confession having been unrebutted in light of the cases that we've had saying that in essence comment to the effect that something has not been rebutted when the defendant is the only person who could have rebutted it can be seen as comment on his failure to testify?
Well, I'd start, Your Honor, with what I was just saying, and that is that government counsel, with regard to each of these segments of evidence, made it clear that he was talking about defense counsel's argument. So with regard to the confession, government counsel said, quote, perhaps the most important thing that is unrebutted is you've heard nothing in defense closing argument about is the defendant's own confession. So it was clear that government counsel was talking about the defendant's closing argument, not about the defendant not testifying. And that's true throughout. Every time the government counsel used the word everybody, talked about defense counsel's closing argument. Defense counsel told you these things were important, this is what's important. Also, there were things that the defense could have done to contest that confession other than the testimony of the defendant. One is the cross-examination of the FBI agents who were there taking the confession. And, in fact, the defendant did engage in cross-examination of those agents. Defense counsel didn't refer to that in his argument, but it is quoted on a couple pages of the government's brief. On pages 39 and 40 of the government's brief, we quote the cross-examination of those two FBI agents. So that's something that the defendant could have done. He could have referred to in his closing argument. And what he said to the FBI agents is, okay, you didn't record the confession, you didn't videotape it, you didn't write it up and have my client sign it. So he undercut the validity of that confession through cross-examination.
Well, cross-examination of a government witness is not the same thing as presenting a witness in rebuttal.
No, but... They are witnesses at trial, and if there's a witness...
But they're the adverse witnesses. Is there anyone else who could have testified about the confession?
Well, to the extent that the confession talked about Tanner's drug-dealing activities and his relationship with Herbe Solis, for example. Solis also testified at trial, and he could have been questioned by defense counsel about the things that were said in that confession.
Let me ask you a different question. I'm bothered by the introduction of guns into evidence. What's the purpose of that? What evidentiary value does it have to have guns in front of the jury?
Let me take a brief moment and talk about the facts there, because I think they can be confusing. There was a pretrial motion in limine to keep the evidence, the guns out, filed by the defense based on relevance and prejudice. There were 9 guns total offered into evidence. At trial, defense objected to only 2 of them, and those objections were on foundation grounds, not on the same grounds as their motion in limine. There were 3 that the defense counsel affirmatively said we don't object to at all. And then there were 4 that were arguably connected with the defendant Tanner.
But the motion in limine, was that to exclude all of them?
It was to exclude all of them. And then with those final...
Well, they didn't abandon that, by making subsequent objections?
I
just don't understand. What is the function of having guns? I don't get it.
Well, those final 4 were...
Is there some argument about whether they're big guns or little guns or...
The indictment argument...
Have triggers or automatics or what?
Indictment alleges the conspiracy began by 1993. And there are a lot more people than just Duke Tanner charged in the conspiracy.
But my question is, why are the guns shown to jurors? I don't understand that. I mean, you have testimony about guns.
I
can say, you know, we have the guns. I don't know why you show them to the jury except to frighten them.
I think it showed to jurors the companionship amongst all these co-conspirators.
Well, I don't understand. How do guns show companionship? What does that mean?
The fact that they were all together that night.
What, all the guns were together that night? What does that have to do with presenting the guns? Putting 9 guns or however many guns in front of a jury doesn't show a relationship between anybody.
The reason the police were called out were because of the guns. And police were called out and all these...
But there's no dispute that there were guns, were there? I mean, was the defendant trying to say, you shouldn't introduce these guns because they didn't... They weren't used? They weren't there? Or what?
No, there's no
issue. So what's the... What is...
In fact, the guns... I remind the court that the standard of review here is abusive.
Look, I don't understand. We see this in a lot of cases. I don't get it, putting guns in front of jurors. We had a case... I heard a case where there was a huge array of guns on the floor of the courtroom, you know, big guns, just to scare them, right?
If they're used in the conspiracy, then they're fair game to introduce into evidence. And looking at, apart from this New Year's Eve party, there was substantial evidence at trial, and proper evidence of Duke Tanner's use of firearms. There was an AK-47 that he received as part of a drug debt.
But there's no dispute that these people had guns, right? So I don't know. I don't see what the physical. I can understand why, for example, in a robbery case, you might present the mask worn by the robber, something of that sort, because it would show that, you know, it was really explain how it was a its utility for. I mean, often a picture can be a lot better evidence than just words. But with the gun, and it's true with the drugs, you show the jury the drugs. But the guns, I don't know why. As I say, there doesn't seem to be any issue about the guns.
It shows the activities of all these co-conspirators, and it had very little effect on the trial, as it turned out, because there was ample evidence of Tanner's use of firearms throughout the conspiracy other than this night. There were something like 7 or 8 different firearms that were testified to other than this night that he came into contact with.
Well, he wasn't charged with a gun.
I'm sorry.
There wasn't a gun charge against him, was there?
A count charging an offense relating to the guns. No, there was not, Your Honor.
Yeah, so there's a lot of evidence of guns that weren't part of his conviction.
There was a sentencing guideline enhancement for use of firearms during the course of the offense.
Is that the? Well, I thought it was life, no matter what. I mean, just because of the amount of drug.
Well, yeah, there were the amount of drugs, the firearms enhancement, and organizer or leader enhancement.
They put it up to 44 or something like that.
Something like that, and the judge, the district court judge, said the amount of drugs themselves were quote astronomical, but all those things figured into the calculations. Amount of drugs, the use of firearms, and the organizer or leader enhancement.
Okay.
So, thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
I ask the court to affirm the conviction.
All right. Okay, thanks. So, Ms. Gambino, your time expired, but if you'd like a minute for rebuttal, you may have it.
First of all, there was no evidence put on that Mr. Tanner was involved in the conspiracy in 1999. The police officers that testified about these guns didn't identify them with any individual at all, and no charges or any other action was taken with respect to these guns. They were not relevant to the conspiracy. They didn't show anything except cause fear in prejudice in front of the jury with respect to this particular case. Mr. Tanner there was no evidence of any gun in his hand apart from out of the mouth of one of the cooperating informants. And that happened in 2003 and 2004. So the guns that were actually admitted were not tied to him, were not tied to drug dealing, and were not tied to the conspiracy. So they were.
Whose guns were they?
They did never establish. The police officers never took names, never established whose guns they
were. Well, how had they obtained the guns?
They came into the house and took them all out of the house, but for whatever reason, they didn't take the names of anyone who happened to have been there. So there was no evidence that Mr. Tanner was even there on that particular evening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so thank you very much, Ms. Kimmy. And were you appointed?
No.
You're appointed? Okay. Well, we thank both of you for a very good argument. Next case for argument.